Okay, thank you, Tony. So this is this is how it's going to work. This is the view graphs are actually for a real down here. Okay, for a real sort of general colloquium, and I'm going to try to pitch it to the neutron star people. And since you guys probably know what a Fermi liquid is, I can speed over some of the introductory parts and get to some of the more advanced things in the last 10 minutes. And also, since Tony gave such a nice introduction, let me say that about 10 years ago, he and Xiaogang Wen made a prediction of a Josephson effect in a charge-E Josephson effect in quantum Hall bilayer systems, which at the time, I have to confess, I thought was totally nutty. And today's talk is going to be about why it was mostly right. So I'm going to talk about how you study the dynamics of electrons, interacting electrons in systems in various dimensions. I'll run out of time to talk about one dimension, actually, but I'll do three and two dimensions. So you all know about free fermions. I just want to set the scale for the neutron star people. The Fermi energy in a metal is maybe 30,000 Kelvin. Here it's 100 Kelvin. The experiments will be done below 1 Kelvin and down to 30 millikelvin. So it'll be in the degenerate regime. And I'm going to start out by talking about a situation where, even though the electrons are interacting, Landau's Fermi liquid theory picture will apply. The interactions, in some sense, are not too strong. And even though you'll have virtual excitations, which will excite particles out of the Fermi sea, it will still turn out that there's a discontinuity of height z, less than 1, but bigger than 0, in the momentum. In the momentum state occupation number. Now, one of the ways that we can probe a Fermi liquid, which I presume is not accessible to neutron star people, is to tunnel in an extra particle and put it near the Fermi sea. And the phase space for it subsequently to decay by emitting particle hole pairs gets smaller and smaller as you get closer and closer to the Fermi surface. And so it turns out that the overlap between the sort of fully dressed interacting quasiparticle and the bare electron which you injected by bringing it in from some other piece of metal through an insulating barrier, that overlap is this same number z, and it's non-zero. So the idea is that it should be relatively easy, if you have the electrons not interacting too strongly, if they are a Fermi liquid, to just send an electron through a barrier and have it suddenly appear in this Fermi gas, Fermi liquid that you're interested in. And it should be relatively easy to tunnel in at with little applied voltage, without having to do any much work on the electron to produce shake-up of various kinds. Okay. All right. So now you have to see some nitty-gritty solid-state physics, Tony. Typical tunneling experiments, such as you would do in aluminum superconductors or normal metal. You'd have aluminum, you'd expose it to the air for a little while, it would make some ugly, glassy oxide, and then you'd put some more aluminum on top. And there's no momentum conservation when the electron passes through this barrier. Of course, there's no conservation of this component of the momentum because there's a barrier, and then it turns out that even this component, because the atoms are kind of randomly located and the potential is pretty random in there, there's no particular momentum conservation. On the other hand, it turns out that's not very important. Basically, this is sort of a weird diagram of position and energy. So you put a voltage on there, and originally, before the voltage was there, the chemical potentials were equal on the two sides. Now they're different, and this set of states of energy width EV, where V is the applied bias, they can tunnel and find empty states over here. And so the tunneling current is linear in the voltage, and you measure this conductance. Now, in principle, this is sensitive to this quasi-particle weight Z, the probability that the electrons can go in there and become dressed and not have a lot of shakeup. But in practice, the actual numerical, this is sort of pretty smooth in voltage, maybe some small wiggles where you can get some information. And the actual height, which in principle tells you something about G, is not really useful because the transmission through this barrier is exponentially sensitive to the thickness and height of the barrier, and we don't really know exactly what those things are. So we can't back out too much information other than the fact that this flat curve is consistent with the paradigm of having a Fermi liquid. Okay? All right, so now, nevertheless, 3D in three dimensions, tunneling between two pieces of three-dimensional metals has been useful for some things, and quite a few things in condensed matter physics. Now I'm going to tell you about tunneling still in three dimensions, but with a different kind of barrier. So you can use this technique of molecular beam epitaxy to grow materials and then switch to a different material to make these heterostructures, which we heard about last Tuesday, I guess, in which you grow these materials one atomic layer at a time, and they are essentially perfect, atomically perfect. These are atomically flat. All the atoms are in the right place. So now you have momentum conservation parallel to the lane. And so the mean free path for electrons, which you can put in this thing, can approach a millimeter at low temperatures, which is pretty amazing. So now if you make a barrier, so the idea is we're going to arrange it so there are electrons in this gallium arsenide side. Here's a barrier of aluminum gallium arsenide, and the electrons can tunnel through to the other side. Now the momentum parallel to this direction is conserved, but it, again, doesn't matter very much because the energy of an electron on this side, it has this kinetic energy plus the potential energy from the battery. It has the same parallel momentum here, but it's allowed to have a different perpendicular momentum because there's no translation symmetry this way to conserve momentum. And it turns out that the fact that these two guys cancel doesn't really matter too much. You can just change this component of the momentum to conserve energy, and it just comes out fairly flat again. So whether you have parallel momentum conservation or not, it's not too important in three dimensions. So now we're going to drop down to two dimensions, and things will be very different. So how do you make a two-dimensional electron gas? Well, you make mostly barrier material and then two places where there are quantum wells. So you can arrange so that there's a potential well here and a potential well here of thickness 100 angstroms or so. And it's not mathematically two-dimensional. It has a finite thickness. But the particle in a box quantization of the energy levels means that the first excited state above this can be 500 Kelvin in energy away, which is effectively infinity for our purposes. So quantum mechanics freezes out this motion, as Bob Schrieffer learned in a little exercise warm-up problem that John Bardeen gave him before he started thinking about superconductivity. So we can treat this as mathematically two-dimensional. Dynamically, it's two-dimensional. So the electrons are free to move around this way and this way, but not this way. Okay. On the other hand, if this barrier is not too high and not too thick, they can occasionally tunnel from one to the other. And you can actually, even though these are only 70 angstroms apart, you can make separate electrical contact to them. At least a few people in the world can. And you can do a tunneling experiment. Well, now you have a different situation. You don't have plane wave states coming in this way and then some different perpendicular momentum there. You're stuck with these discrete energy levels, which are basically the same on both sides. And if you have parallel momentum conservation, you can't conserve energy unless the voltage is zero. Okay? So it's totally different circumstance. And the conductance looks totally different. So this is Dana Murphy and Jim Eisenstein. And this is the conductance, the derivative of the current with respect to applied voltage versus voltage. And instead of a flat featureless curve, you see a sharp peak whose width is a couple Kelvin, and E Fermi is 100 Kelvin, so it's narrow. Okay? And as you lower the temperature, it gets narrower and narrower and taller and taller. But it eventually saturates, and that's because of there's some slight momentum non-conservation from the few impurities and imperfections that are in these systems. But it's approximately true that there's no tunneling except at essentially zero voltage. Well, that's sort of amusing, but what is it good for? Well, it turns out you can probe the shape of the Fermi surface by doing a trick, applying some magnetic field that is in the plane separating the two layers, okay? So if an electron tunnels, goes over here, tunnels back, and goes there, it picks up some Aronoff Bohm phase from the enclosed flux. Or equivalently, when it tunnels, the Lorentz force causes it to curve and it picks up some momentum. So there's a way to get a momentum by having this parallel field. Now, the tricky thing with momenta in magnetic fields is you have to distinguish mechanical and canonical, and you have to say what gauge you're in. So in the first part of the talk, I'm going to use this gauge. I'm going to have a B field which is pointing in the Y direction, and the vector potential will point in the minus X direction, but it'll vary in the Z direction. Okay? So that has a curl, which is just a constant. So the kinetic energy goes from P squared to P plus A squared. And now the neat thing is that if these are really two-dimensional, the vector potential is just a constant in each layer. Electrons moving around, in order to feel a curl or pick up a phase, it would have to go this way. Moving around inside the plane, the vector potential is just a constant. Okay? So in the first layer, that constant is zero, and in the second layer, it's just some number. And so the dispersion relation shifts from kx squared plus ky squared to kx minus some q squared plus ky squared, where q is proportional to the applied field. So that doesn't mean that all of the electrons in the second layer are flying along at some tremendous speed, because this is the Fermi C shifts, but that's the canonical momentum, not the mechanical momentum, right? So the canonical momentum of the Fermi C has shifted over, but that doesn't mean they're all moving, because the velocity is P plus A. On the other hand, it's canonical momentum, which is conserved, when you tunnel, at least in this gauge, since canonical momentum is not observable, whether or not it's conserved depends on what gauge you pick. And so you can shift one of the two Fermi Cs relative to the other and then do a tunneling experiment. So here are the Fermi surfaces. Okay, these are the surfaces in K space with the same energy. And since canonical momentum in this gauge is conserved during the tunneling, energy and momentum are conserved only at those two points. So when there's no shift, you have a huge overlap, and immediately there's almost no overlap. Okay? And this is what the conductance looks like as a function of this parallel magnetic field. Here is when there's the big conductance with this overlap. Immediately, almost instantaneously, it drops down to a very small value. And then just as the two surfaces depart each other, there's a little singularity because of the two flat parts are nearly flat and parallel there. And so you can immediately deduce the Fermi rate, the radius of the Fermi surface, and if it weren't round, if you had some anisotropy in the crystal which caused it to be elliptical in shape, you would be, by tilting the parallel magnetic field in different directions, you could map out that entire shape. There's also some similar things you can do by having different radii of Fermi C and stuff, but I'll skip over that. Anyway, the momentum at which this little peak occurs is consistent with what we know from other measurements, what the density of electrons is, and therefore the Fermi wave vector. It tells us that Fermi liquid theory is working in this system. Well, there's a lot of interest in the high TC community and whether or not you have non-Fermi liquid situations where interactions are somehow causing some non-perturbative effect that makes Landau's argument not work anymore. So here is a simple example where we know it's not a Fermi liquid. Namely, we put on, instead of a parallel magnetic field, we put on a very strong perpendicular magnetic field. And since the neutron people deal with really strong magnetic fields, this idea of Landau levels must be familiar to you, although because we're in two dimensions, there's no momentum along the field direction, then these Landau levels are completely degenerate. They're macroscopically degenerate, and there's no dispersion from the Z component of the momentum. And that macroscopic degeneracy just represents all the different places you can put the little circular orbits of the electrons in the sample. So the kinetic energy is quenched, and at a few Tesla field, this energy scale is 100 Kelvin, again, effectively infinity for our purposes. And once you've quenched the kinetic energy, there's no scale against which to measure the strength of the interactions. And so, you're doing degenerate perturbation theory on some gigantic manifold of degenerate states of interacting particles. Now, so something strange happens. For instance, we think of bound states as happening when particles are attracted to each other and go into orbit around each other. But here, even repulsive interactions cause bound states or anti-bound states. Because if I put two particles close to each other, normally they would just fly apart, converting their potential energy to kinetic. But here, there is no kinetic energy. They can't, at least in order to get any kinetic energy, you'd have to do it in this discrete amount. So that means that even particles that repel each other stay bound together. So this makes the system interacting sort of infinitely strongly and not a Fermi liquid. So in particular, what would happen if I did a tunneling experiment where I have these two layers of two-dimensional electron gases far apart, and suddenly out of the blue arrives another electron from the other layer? If there were no magnetic field, the other electrons would just get out of the way, and there'd be some finite amplitude that you could land in a potential energy state which is favorable, and kinetic energy near the Fermi level, and you would just be a Landau quasiparticle. But here, when you put somebody in and everybody tries to escape, the Lorentz force sends them around in circles and they can't escape. So there's very bad screening and very strong interactions in this system. And in fact, there's a gap or a pseudo gap produced in the tunneling spectrum. There's basically no current can flow. Nobody can tunnel until you supply a finite voltage to pay the Coulomb correlation price of landing in the middle of these other electrons. And the scale of this peak is the charge square, the dielectric constant of the semiconductor, and the spacing between the electrons, or the magnetic length. And so you would expect that the Fermi liquid quasiparticle, just the concept doesn't mean anything, and there's essentially a gap here. So here's what the data looks like. This is tunnel current versus voltage, and you see this gap, and the scale of the gap is about 60 Kelvin, which is about half of the characteristic Coulomb scale in the system, so it seems to make sense. So why does that's a good question. So suppose I put in more voltage. Well, if you put in a lot of voltage, you got a lot of energy. You can give some. You get the potential energy from being stuck near these other electrons, but you can't burn off the rest in kinetic energy. So the current actually goes back down again, and it's allowed to have negative differential resistance. People make devices out of that effect. You can make oscillators and so forth. So it actually goes back down again. So there's sort of, in the spectral density, there's one bump, which is there's sort of one characteristic Coulomb scale, and it's not, there are small fluctuations in the density of electrons where you land that gives this, but it's once you get up to high energies, there's just no way to burn off that energy. Now, notice that there's two curves here. These are actually for slightly different spatial separations of the two electron gases, thicknesses of the barrier. One is, the dashed line is 340 angstroms thick. The solid line is 175 angstroms thick. And you see that the size of the Coulomb scale is slightly smaller when the barrier is thinner. And that's due to something that had been sought for many, many years, and this is the first time that it was seen, an excitonic attraction between the particle that tunneled and the hole that it left behind. And if you look at the scale of this reduction, it's about 0.4 e squared over the spacing, which is sort of makes sense, right? The right sort of scale. Okay, so here's the million-dollar question. What if you make the layers a little bit closer together and you make this excitonic attraction a little bigger? Does anything interesting happen? And Tony Z said 10 years ago, this really wild and strange thing happened. And the only thing I can say is that he said that, and it's true, but he didn't have any numbers in his paper. And so it took the rest of us. Yeah, I know. It's a particle physics. It's a very field theory paper. He said, there's a symmetry. Let's break it. Which seemed insane at the time, but in fact is correct. And with a few years' work, we put some numbers into it. Okay, so in practice, it's very expensive to make new samples with different thicknesses. So it turns out it's easier to vary the spacing between the electrons, and just this dimensionless ratio is really all that counts. But that's an aside. Okay, so here's the tunnel conductance as you go from, I'll just describe it in terms of wide separation and small separation just to keep the language simple. So here's two electron gases far apart. You tunnel in. Now this is DIDV, so it's symmetric in V, but you see the gap there. There's no tunneling, no conductance at small voltages. You bring them a little closer together. Well, that's sort of the excitonic effect is pulling that energy scale in. And then you see, well, there's some funny little thing there. And then you make it 10% closer together, and you say, who ordered that? It's amazing. It's a huge spike in the differential conductance at essentially zero voltage, just popping out of nowhere. So this was published in PRL this June, Jim Eisenstein and company. And it represents a quantum phase transition to a new ground state. So quantum phase transitions are something that are being discussed in the ITC workshop. And it's a phase transition that happens not because you change temperature, but because you change some parameter in the Hamiltonian, and the ground state undergoes some major reorganization. And this is, you know, clearly something has changed dramatically to kill off this gap in the tunneling spectrum. So some sort of reorganization has happened. Well, what is it? Well, when the layers get closer together, in fact, just to give you a sense of scale, the spacing between the electrons is about 100 angstroms, and that you dope into this heterostructure, and the layer thickness is about 100 angstroms. So they're comparable, which means that the Coulomb correlations within a layer and between layers are roughly the same magnitude. Okay? And so if you get these layers close enough, they're going to start being correlated in some way. And here's a model, which I'll set up as a straw person, which seems good but doesn't work. Okay, so the first model is, let's make a bilayer Wigner crystal. Let's put we don't really have any kinetic energy anyway, so let's just localize the electrons in a way that will minimize their Coulomb energy. And in the other layer, we will do the same thing, except we'll put them in registry in such a way that they also minimize their mutual Coulomb repulsion. And that's a very good variational state, actually. It has low energy. But it's the wrong physics, which you can tell just from the tunneling experiment. Because, so here's a sort of side view. There's the Wigner crystal in the upper layer, the electrons in the lower layer, and they're shifted to minimize their mutual energy. Very good energy, but it can't be right, because when an electron tunnels from here to here, sure, it doesn't land right on top of the other electrons, but it lands very, very close. And since those electrons are in a crystal, they can't fly apart very well, independent of the fact that the Lorentz force isn't going to let them fly apart. And so there's going to be a big energy gap on this scale from producing a vacancy interstitial pair in those two Wigner crystals. Also, it turns out that this Wigner crystal, because it breaks translation symmetry, will be pinned by random imperfections in the sample and not conduct electricity. And it's known that there's a good quantum Hall state here where the electrons can flow. What is the temperature? It could be melted. But then you would be back to this. All right, then I'll rely on the Lorentz force, which says these other guys can't get out of the way. Okay, we can talk about it. Okay, so I would claim that the tunneling is telling us something completely different kind of physics is going on. And the point is that strong tunneling only occurs near zero voltage. That means that you can remove an electron from one layer, inject it in the other, and still be very close to the ground state. Because you don't have to do any work to make that happen. You don't have to apply any voltage. Well, that's a very strange state, because it means that this operator, I'm going to introduce an isospin or pseudospin. Up means you're in the upper layer, down means you're in the lower layer, and we'll forget about real spin for simplicity. So that means that this operator, which doesn't conserve isospin, condenses. That you can, that's allowed actually by quantum mechanics. You can have electrons, you can have no tunneling between the layers. I could turn that off. and still be in a state where I'm uncertain which layer each electron is in. That's allowed by quantum mechanics. And it's possible in a broken symmetry state for that to be not zero. And that was Tony's idea that I didn't believe. So now let me just introduce a little notation. So this pseudo spin, up means you're in the upper layer, down you're in the lower layer, and you might be in 1 over root 2 up plus down, which means the spin is, pseudo spin is sideways, right? And I can introduce a spin a half pseudo spin vector, and spin flip, where you go from up to down or down to up, that's tunneling. So we have to find a state which is essentially an eigenstate of sigma x, where this pseudo spin is somewhere, or x or sigma y, where it's in the xy plane, so you have a linear combination of these two possibilities. And when you apply the tunneling operator, you get back some overlap with the same state. So this correlated state is going to be a pseudo spin ferromagnet, it turns out. So I can make up a linear combination of the two layers with different amplitudes and phases, and imagine all the electrons, say, have the same pseudo-spin orientation. If it's all up, that's bad. That means all the electrons are up here, and I have a charged capacitor. So, and if it's down, that's bad. So this is magnet has some easy plane anisotropy. It doesn't want to be up or down. It wants to be somewhere in the xy plane. Now, why does it, we see why it doesn't want to be up or down, but why does it want to be in the xy plane? Well, in the xy plane, the Hartree charging energy is minimized, and if everybody has their pseudo spins pointing in the same direction, the more quantum numbers you have in common with somebody else, the more likely Pauli is going to keep you away from them, and so the Coulomb energy will be lower. And in fact, this state is completely isospin exchange symmetric, so it has to be completely spatial antisymmetric. And so we use these complex numbers, x plus iy, to represent the position vector in this two-dimensional space. And this magnet is actually, we can write down what is more or less the exact ground state of the magnet, namely it's this symmetric guy times this funny polynomial, which is happens to correspond to solution of the Schrodinger equation for the lowest Landau level. So this is a completely anti-symmetric function of the coordinates, and it's well known from Bob Laughlin's solution of the quantum Hall problem. And it has the advantage that if any two particles approach each other, whether they're in the same layer or different layers, this product vanishes. And so the particles are avoiding each other, whether they're in the same layer or different layers. And that's good, because that means that the layers were already correlated ahead of time in such a way that the electrons down here saw this guy coming. When it arrives, they were already avoiding that place. So that's why you don't have to pay the Coulomb cost. And just to further motivate this wave function, if you had the layers on top of each other but still no tunneling, then the Coulomb interaction would be the same whether you're in the same layer or different layer. So the Hamiltonian would commute with isospin, and this isospin ferromagnet would be an exact eigenstate. So the idea is to then you have this highly degenerate set of magnetic orientations for the isospin, and that degeneracy is lifted by the pulling the layers apart, but the state isn't much states aren't much modified. Yes. If there's no tunneling, then the electrons can't know whether there's any parallel magnetic field. The only way an electron can find out if there's any magnetic field is to tunnel here, go there, tunnel back, go there. If they can't tunnel, they don't know. So then it's not critical that it be tilted, but in a minute I'm going to show you that if there is tunneling and you tilt it, interesting things happen. A good question. Okay, so this is a funny state, as I said, in which the tunneling operator condenses and lies somewhere, the magnetization lies somewhere in the xy plane described by this angle phi, and sigma plus, which is sigma x plus I sigma y, is e to the I phi. Okay, well, once the tunneling operator condenses, that means that the current fluctuations are all near zero frequency, and the Kubo formula tells you that the conductance will all happen near zero frequency or zero voltage. And in addition to this ground state, you can have spin wave excitations. Because it's normally in a ferromagnet, you have omega goes like k squared, but in an easy plane anti-ferromagnet, you get Goldstone mode with linear dispersion. And the velocity of the mode is about 0.1 e squared over the dielectric constant times h. If I put a c there and a c up here, you get 10 to the minus 2 alpha times the speed of light, which is 10 to the fourth meters per second. So it's pretty slow. So we'd like to study that mode, but we need to get some momentum. But then we know how to do that now. We get that from parallel magnetic field. So that's essentially what you were asking about. And, completely unknown to us in 1963, Doug. Anyway, one of Doug's, he tells me his sixth or seventh paper, he looked at a Josephson junction experiment where they saw some funny structure when they did tunneling in the presence of parallel magnetic field. And looking at what turned out to be the dispersion of the Swihart mode, which is some collective mode, electromagnetic mode confined inside the two pieces of metal. And also there's a related thing in the so-called Carlson-Goldman experiment. So you can get momentum from parallel magnetic field. So the idea, roughly speaking, is that in the absence of parallel magnetic field, we saw there was a huge spike in the conductance at zero voltage because you were just going in, into the condensate, so to speak. But put on finite momentum and create a spin wave with wave vector q, then it's going to cost me an energy, h bar omega q, and I should see then a little spike in the tunnel current at a voltage which moves outward as I increase the wave vector and therefore increase the energy of the spin wave that I'm shaking off. Okay? So here is the tunnel conductance versus voltage with zero parallel field, and you see this huge spike. And as soon as you put on parallel field, that gets killed off. And then if you're among the faithful, and we look closely, there's a little shoulder which comes out and disperses, which is the Goldstone mode. Let me blow that up for you. This is Jim Eisenstein. Unpublished, but discussed at Aspen this summer. So here's the remnant of the zero voltage peak. Here's this extra guy, and maybe you could fit, and there's a little shoulder there, maybe you could fit a dispersion to that. This is this very first data just out of the experiment, so I'm sure it will improve, but the velocity is on the same page as we estimate, so it seems hopeful. Okay, so let me now talk about why. Yes. Yeah, this is some time-dependent Hartree-Fock calculation that's probably pretty good down here, and that, yeah, it's very likely that there is a Roton minimum, which is actually a precursor. This is an indication that bilayer Wigner crystal state is not too far away in energy. This is the wave vector for that instability. Okay, so now let me talk about some complications that are interesting physics, I think. So we know that when we have a magnet with an easy plane anisotropy, we can just describe the fluctuations out of the plane are massive. We can just talk about the phase fluctuations. And we have some action like this, roughly speaking. And the stiffness, which in two dimensions has units of energy because there's two derivatives and two integrals, the scale of that is 0.4 Kelvin. It's calculated in Hartree Fock. So you can make topological defects, vortices, anti-vortices. They'll interact logarithmically, and there's this well-known Costa-Lastalis phase transition in which at a temperature on the scale of rho s, if you go above that, these topological defects, which are attracting each other logarithmically, deconfine, run around, and destroy the quasi-long-range order in the phase, because the phase winds by 2 pi if you go around those things. Well, consistent with that idea is the fact that this giant peak in the tunnel conductance at zero parallel magnetic field turns on at about 0.4 Kelvin. So that makes sense. On the other hand, well, okay, there's something strange about these vortices. They carry fermion number plus or minus a half. And the reason is that when you take an electron around them, or you take you take this spin around, when you rotate a spin a half, you get e to the I pi when you go around the equator. Various phases is minus one. And it turns out that that together with the quantization of the Hall conductivity guarantees that these objects carry fermion number plus or minus a half. And in, if you like nonlinear sigma models, there's the fermion number is related to the topological density of the magnetization vector. And whether you get a charge plus a half or minus a half, so you don't know whether the various phase is pi or minus pi, and that ambiguity is resolved in the core by whether the pseudospin tips up or down, whether this extra charge is in the upper layer or the lower layer. So there are four flavors of these vortices: right-handed, left-handed, charge a half, and charge minus a half. They're all the charge is the product of whether they're up or down times the handedness. Now, normally these things just freeze out at zero temperature because they cost some, they're logarithmically confined. But now we don't have any time reversal symmetry, and it turns out that a random scalar potential can induce a random vector potential. I mean, this is time reversal odd, and the scalar potential is time reversal even. But it's okay, because you don't have time reversal symmetry, because there's a big magnet. So you get a random, it's called a gauge glass kind of a model. And this guy has some curl, and it can induce vortices. You can just, in the ground state, even at zero temperature, these things won't freeze out. And it turns out, or at least in our scenario for what's going on, that's important. Why? Because the height, this isn't really the Josephson effect, which would have kind of infinite conductance at zero voltage. This gigantic peak isn't really gigantic, it's actually tiny. It's 10 to the minus 2 e squared over h, where e squared over h is the quantum of conductance, 1 over 25,000 ohms. And it doesn't have zero width the way it should. It's got a couple Kelvin width. And what we think is going on is that the system is actually loaded with these disorder-induced vortices. And you can imagine that the phase-phase correlator is actually short-range in space and time because of the dynamics of these things. And in a phenomenological fit to this, and I should also say, by the way, I forgot to mention at the beginning that Leon Valence and Leo Razahovsky have also worked on this recently and have very similar ideas, that this disorder and motion of these defects can make this correlator short range in time, which is what kills off what gives the width to that peak. And a phenomenological fit to the height and width is consistent with the density of vortices being very high, every 12 magnetic lengths, and the characteristic time scale being that length divided by the Goldstone velocity. Now, that's not really a theory of what's going on, but it sort of seems to all hang together phenomenologically. Right. So why don't these things? Well, if you look at the transport in this thing, it's not a very good quantum Hall step. There's a rho xx is a kiloohm. So that evidently, it's a many body. It requires correlations to form this state, and they're not strong enough to make a really good dissipationless state. So just we know from transport they're moving around. So we just made a model that said they're moving around and looked at to see if the numbers make sense. Hopefully in future samples, that won't happen. We'll see. Okay, so two-dimensional tunneling is very different from three-dimension because you don't have this freedom of different momenta in the third direction. You can grow samples that conserve parallel momentum with this wonderful molecular beam epitaxy. You can boost the parallel momentum during tunneling by having a magnetic field there. You can use that trick to map out Fermi surfaces. If you add magnetic field perpendicular to there, it destroys the Fermi liquid, gives you strong Coulomb interactions, and if you have the layers close together, then you can optimize the exchange energy between the layers by having the electrons be in both layers at the same time, and you're uncertain which layer you're in. That is, you're in a pseudo-spin ferromagnetic state, which we believe explains this nice enormous peak in the conductance, which is either enormous or small, depending on your mood. Okay, thanks. Yeah. So in a superconductor, the way that the Josephson effect works is you have a condensate, and you want to be, you're going to a state where you're uncertain how many Cooper pairs are in there. And then you can inject another Cooper pair and still be in the ground state. So there's a proposal, again from Tony and Xiaogang, that the real, a nice analog of this real Josephson effect would be to have a double layer system interrupted by a barrier. I didn't say that the super current that corresponds to grad phi is this, it's anti-symmetric current in the layers, because the charge that's conjugate to the xy component of the spin is sigma z, which is the difference in the charge density between the layers. So you would have a supercurrent like that hopping across this barrier and doing that. And the order parameter I didn't mention, but this is gauge neutral. It doesn't have any net charge, so that's why this thing can move around in a magnetic field and not get loaded up with vortices unless there's dirt present. And that's why the magnetic field here doesn't screw up the tunneling across that weak link. Right now, making such a sample and having a nice symmetry between those two layers, which you need, looks very difficult. But I've had a conversation with Horst Stormer, who dreamed up while we were walking up Fifth Avenue or something, some cleaved edge overgrowth thing that sort of looks like that, but not quite. So whether this shows an effect, can experiment can ultimately be done. Right now, I don't know, but it looks hard. But it's good not to underestimate what the experiments will do. Right. Good question. So suppose I have these two levels, and then I let the tunneling get very, very strong. The tunneling in these samples is, the amplitude is 85 microkelvin, so it's very, very small. But suppose it were 10 Kelvin. Then you would split apart into a symmetric and an anti-symmetric band, and then it would look like basically one wide well, and everybody could sit down here. There's just enough room at this density to put everybody in that state. And then it would be an ordinary integer quantum Hall effect. The essence of the broken symmetry is that it does this anyway. It puts everybody into the symmetric bonding state, or maybe it's the anti-symmetric. It doesn't matter. You can't actually tunnel, so you don't know the actual relative phase, but you do know about phase gradients because they cost you exchange energy. If two electrons approach each other and you don't know which layer they're in a linear combination. If they have the same phase for that linear combination, then they can't get close to each other because of Pauli. If they have slightly different phases, they can get a little closer and the Coulomb energy goes up, and that's where this 0.4 Kelvin comes from. So it's the same state, but it happens spontaneously without any actual tunneling. Right. Even when there's zero tunneling, it does that. Another way to say the definition of the spontaneously broken symmetry is that if I turn on just a little bit of tunneling that favors phi equals zero, the symmetric mode, the energy shift is first order in T, not second order in T. That's the definition of broken symmetry. So under pressure, you can make the G factor go, which is minus 0.4 for you neutron guys. You can make it go to zero. It's very solid. It's a solid lattice effect. In that case, you can get actually. There are some examples of Ising anisotropy where you can get sort of two flavors of these things, and you get hysteresis and domain walls and things between these Ising degrees of freedom rather than this continuous broken symmetry. You have that. I can point you to references, but I'm not expert on it. But anytime you get two quantum numbers and you can tune them to be degenerate, you can get interesting combinations of unbroken symmetry. Okay. Well, these vortices are merons. They're half a skirmion, and they're stable because of the easy plane anisotropy. So that out here, the spins go like that, and near the core, they turn up or down, and the topological density is plus a half or minus a half. In one dimension. Okay. My student Aditi Mitra will talk about this November 3rd or something, I think. In one dimension, it's possible now to make a very thin barrier, 80 angstroms thick, very smooth, and have electrons come up in a strong magnetic field and bounce off that barrier. So without a magnetic field, you know, electrons approach the barrier and they reflect. They get one chance to go through. But when you're in a strong magnetic field, you're bouncing off of this wall and the Lorentz force keeps coming back, and you get many attempts. And you can form, if there is some tunneling, you can form a coherent superposition of being on both sides at the same time and lower the exchange energy and open up a gap. And there's a recent experiment from Wuan Kang at Chicago and Horst Stormer where they see in the middle of a tunneling conductance with a big gap, they see a spike, which I think is the same physics, but in one dimension.
Mm-hmm.